Yes, it is, especially if you're going to go to Mars or someplace, very important. But they asked me about how I felt about that, and I looked at John and said, look, I want to fly in space so badly, I'd fly with a baboon. And John understood, you know, instead of taking umbrage at that, he understood exactly what I meant, and we were good friends before and after that.
He was quite the guy. So you did the first rendezvous and docking maneuvers then to demonstrate the capability. How did that come about?
Well, the thing we were most worried about in the moon sequence of events was the rendezvous and docking. And we had Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin had graduated number two in his class at West Point. He'd gone on to MIT, which is, you know, not too shabby. And he not only had a PhD from MIT, but his doctoral dissertation was in rendezvous and docking. And that was exactly what we were looking for in NASA at that time. So we welcomed Buzz with open arms. Now, when we went to cocktail parties, you try not to sit next to Buzz. Because Buzz would say, well, the perilune and the apogee has got a renominous sensation of 0.05 between here and there. And, it wore a little bit, but God, he was a terrific crewmate. But where was I? So anyway, I got into that program, and I was assigned with John Young to Gemini 10, which was a nice little flight. A nice little two-seater. It was a nice little flying machine. We set a world altitude record, and I did a couple of spacewalks, which were interesting, and it was nice. It was a good little program. I like Gemini.
That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
So, Joe, meanwhile, you're still at Edwards, I think, for part of this flying X-15s, right?
I'm still trying to figure out what my excuse was for blowing that tank off the 104. Yeah, Mike and I went to the Aerospace Research Pilot School together in the same class. Yeah. And when we finished school, it was about the time that NASA had announced they were going to select another group, I believe. The timing was about there. And General Twigg Branch, who was the commander at Edwards, was a great, great guy. He called me, I got word through the test ops commander that General Branch wanted to see you. Normally, when General Branch wants to see you, you've done something that you wish you probably would like to rethink about and not do it again.
Sorry,
but he was a good guy.
Say that again?
Branch, General Branch at Edwards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he had called me into his office, so I went in and I reported in like you're supposed to, I thought. And he said, sit down, Engel. And so I, yes, sir. And he said, I see your application here for NASA, the NASA program, the next group of astronauts. And I said, well, yes, sir. Because everybody in our class was, about everybody applied that year in our class. And I didn't want to get left behind, so I filled out the application. And it was laying there on his desk. And he picked it up and he looked at it. He says, well, I don't think I'm going to approve this one. So he just tore it apart and threw it back down. And I stood there kind of with my mouth open, I guess. He said, that's all. I said, yes, sir. And I turned around again. I didn't know why, but found out later that he wasn't going to approve my application because he had earmarked to fly the X-15 to take Bob White's place on the X-15 team.
Yeah.
Bob was going to go to Germany to take over a wing. So I didn't know that at the time, and I just thought, well, I just didn't qualify. I wasn't even in the running. So I was happy. I went back to test ops, and we had 104s to fly, 105s, we had a bunch of different, a whole ramp full of airplanes. And at that time, the philosophy in the Air Force, at least in the flight test community, was to encourage the pilots to fly as many different kinds of airplanes as you could, so that when you got a new airplane as a project, you'd have a good yardstick to measure it with, which made sense. And of course, to all the pilots, all the young buck pilots like Mike and I, we loved that idea of flying everything you can get your hand on. Shoot, Navy airplanes would come in there for spend the weekend, and you'd go down to the flight line and try and talk the crew chief into letting you fly it around a little bit. Worked out okay.
So the X-15, when you were flying the X-15, Joe, Neil had been working ahead of you on the X-15 program.
That's right.
Neil Armstrong. And he was more, in his flights, chasing the speed records, and you were going after the altitude. Is that right?
We had two basic profiles with the X-15. Was the low altitude speed or heating profile, to study the heating characteristics at hypersonic speeds,
yeah,
and how the shock waves affected the responsiveness of the airplane, the stability of the airplane. And then the other goal of the X-15 program was to develop a control system and a technique to fly back in from space with a winged vehicle and recover it on a dry lake bed or recover it on a runway. So, yeah, they tended to kind of compartment you a little bit just for familiarity with the profile, so that you were more easily recognized when you were drifting off or when something abnormal was happening.
And talk a little bit about Neil's flight where he got lofted and had trouble getting back to the lake bed.
Neil was kind of the new guy, new NASA guy on the X-15 team, new pilot guy. And he had a project called the G-Limiter on the X-15, where Minneapolis Honeywell was attempting to put in into the flight control system a device, a mechanical device that would limit you as to how many G's you could pull. You could set this little deal and set the counterbalance back and forth, and it would limit how many G's you could pull with the airplane. The idea being, when we did get up to the higher altitudes, you could overstress the airplane re-entering by pulling past 5.5 G's after subjecting it to the thermal temperatures of getting out through the atmosphere. So Neil had set that flight for, I believe it was 4 G's, 3.5 or 4 G's, as a progression to checking it out. And he had gone to not a really extremely high altitude, I can't remember the altitude, 220 or 230,000, and he was re-entering and was pulling back and brought the G level up to the limit, about the limit, and he was trying to see if when he put more stick in, if it would pull more G's, or if the G limiter was going to hold him, keep him from doing it. And he got so focused on trying to see whether the G limiter was active or not that he held 3.5 or 4 G's until he stopped his descent, and then he held the G's and it started lofting him back up again. And by the time he saw that he was heading back uphill, he was already getting out of the dense atmosphere, couldn't get a bite into the atmosphere to pull back in, and lofted out over Burbank. He ended up over Burbank. And he stretched it back in. I got to tell you, boy, he went right to the max L over D angle of attack, blew everything off that he didn't need, and glided to the end. But instead of hitting overhead key, heading north to south at 40,000 feet, he came in from the south, didn't have an overhead, he came straight in and kind of knocked a few cactus trees out of the way and landed on the south end of it. But he got it back, he got the airplane back.
It's outstanding. So then you're checking in at NASA, and I guess we all have heard, and I had my own experience with medical tests and all that. What was there any truth to what we see in some of the movies about the rigor of the medical tests as you enter into the program, Mike? We had a guy, for instance, who was part of the surgeons that would check us out, and his name was Dr. Hind. So you can imagine what his role was. Was he there when you guys were there?
No. I thought most of it was quite legitimate and probably rigorous. The tests I remember in particular, they assigned two flight surgeons to my body, and One looked in the left ear, one looked in the right ear. They didn't see each other. I was in.
You were home.
Now, however, the previous year I had flunked. And I think I did okay on, you know, that very sensible test where they poured cold water into one ear. You remember that one? Anyway, this one was the psychiatric test, and it was a whole series of Rorschach ink blots. And I was aces at that. Oh, that looks like I'm not allowed to say that. But then the last one was a blank piece of paper, 8 by 10 or 10 by 14, a huge piece of white, empty paper. And I had to say what I saw. And I said, well, of course, it's 11 polar bears fornicating in a snowbank. And I...
11?
Well, no, I thought that was mildly amusing, but I could see the interrogator scowl, and I flunked. And then the next year, I flunked the NASA application. Next year, I came back and I saw my mother and my father, and my father was a little bit taller than my mother, and lo and behold, I passed. That's my story.
Trainable, right?
What? One thing. You saw 11 polar bears fornicating?
Joe, you don't want to sweat the details.
Okay.
Thanks for sharing that. So... I'm not sure I transition to the next one after that.
Say what?
I'm trying to figure out a transition after that.
Yeah.
So a little bit about family life, because the program was fast and furious, and you guys are doing all kinds of stuff, traveling, experimenting, and flying stuff for the first time. What was life generally like as you're moving through the program?